Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, September the 6th, 1995. In a fireside room this morning, our speaker is Ron Burke, and he will be speaking on the lighter side of faith. You don't have to chase rabbits all the time. Let's listen in on Ron Burke.
I'm a Lutheran. German Lutheran. And we have ways of making you start on time. So. My name is Ron Burke, and this is the third in the series, The Lighter Side of Faith. And this particular session is entitled, You Don't Have to Chase Rabbits All the Time. Now, those of you who have been in the other couple of sessions know that I know what happens at Holden Village, that just because, especially after the coffee break, it's hard to get people down here, and people will slowly come in. So following the lead of dramatists in plays and theater, we kind of entertain and reward those of you who came early the first few minutes, waiting for the latecomers to come in, and then we will get into the meat of the thing after the flock is gathered. So there, explain a little bit to you what's going on. How many of you are here from, I won't say small, but rural congregations? Bunch of you. Okay. How many of you, I know Texans are probably familiar with a fellow, a stand-up comedian by the name of Jeff Foxworthy. I don't know whether Jeff Foxworthy has made it into the Midwest. He is the guy who has been famous for the little books on You Might Be a Redneck If. Have you seen those? You know, You Might Be a Redneck If. Anybody know what a redneck is? Okay, we do have some more seats over here. Well, in that line, I have come up and done some research, and you know, you might be in a country church if, and these are some ways to know that you might be in a country church. You might be in a country church if there are more pickup trucks in the parking lot than cars. You might be in a country church if you can look out the church window and see straight down the row of a cornfield. Corn. I have to explain some things to Iron.
I was talking to her.
Well, you shouldn't be talking to her. She's a Texan. You might be a in a country church if there's a boot scraper by the front door. If the restroom is outside, you might be in a country church.
Yes.
You might be in a Texas country church if the opening of deer hunting season is recognized as an official church holiday. You might be in a country church if after a funeral service, people walk to the cemetery for the burial. You might be in a country church, in Texas at least, if the property and maintenance committee has a line item in its budget for baling wire or duct tape in particular parts of the country. You might be in a country church if 3 feet of the steeple is missing because of a crop duster. You might be at a country church in Texas if the preacher says, I'd like to ask Bubba to help take up the offering. And 5 guys stand up. You might be at a country church if worship that begins at 8:15 is considered the late service. And you might be at a country church if there is more silver in belt buckles than in the offering plate. Texas side. How are we doing on vacancies over there? We've about filled up over here?
We have one.
A table for one? Okay. Keep that in mind. We have one here.
Two back here.
Some over there. The balcony is one angel in the balcony. A Texas angel. That's good. Okay. Just one more thing, talking about the rural churches. I write a column in our Southwest Texas Synod paper. It's kind of a column of humor and reflection. And I try to keep it down, as they say, keep the fodder down where the calves can reach it. And I wrote a little thing about a year ago that maybe is worth sharing here for making sure that all the flock is here. When Pastor Forrest Crying Out Loud came to St. Martin's Lutheran Church in the mid-1980s, he soon discovered that the little hill country Texas country church with its membership of predominantly German-American farmers and ranchers was a bit behind its neighboring congregations in the practice of contemporary worship customs. For example, other Lutheran congregations were involving more and more lay people in the worship, but not at St. Martin's. That's the pastor's job, they said. That's what we pay him for. There was, however, one modern attitude toward worship at St. Martin's, and that was the complaint about the length of the service, especially on communion Sundays. In the old days, they were in no hurry to leave church and go home. Dinner and nap could wait while they got their contribution's worth out of worship and leisurely visited with their neighbors afterwards. But that was in the days B.C., before cowboys. Now that Dallas Cowboy professional football fever had caught on, they wanted to make sure there was plenty of time for them to get from the back pews in church to their front row seats before the TV sets. So when Pastor Crying Out Loud pointed out that having lay people assist him with the distribution of the bread during communion would shorten the service on those Sundays, there was more openness to this new custom than usual. In fact, after only one referral to committee, the church council adopted the proposal on a four-month trial basis, September through December. Emil Alftervall was the obvious and unanimous choice to be the first communion assistant. Not only was he recognized as the lay leader at St. Martin's, but Emil also had another reputation that in the eyes of many of his fellow members qualified him for the job, and that was his skill as a Scot player. This traditional German game was still quite popular in the community, and Emil's talent at dealing the cards faster and more orderly than anyone else around was admired by all. Though not spoken about during the church discussions, this ability was high in the minds of those who were thinking about speeding up the service. If Emil could deal cards quickly, he could do the same with thin communion wafers. And this would cut down even more the time between church benediction and cowboy's introduction. So everything looked great for the successful implementation of something new into the long-time traditional worship customs of St. Martin's Lutheran Church. But alas, this was not to be. One of Emil Alftervall's little habits had been overlooked, one that was suddenly and glaringly apparent before he had completed distributing the wafers for the first group of worshipers who came and knelt before the altar. Emil's fellow members had forgotten that what it was that made him such a rapid dealer of cards. Their oversight was understandable because what he did was quite socially acceptable at the card table, but shockingly offensive at the Lord's table. You see, Emil had this habit before he dealt each card of wetting his tongue. of wetting his thumb with his tongue, a habit which he unconsciously brought with him to the church altar rail as he handed out each communion wafer. And Emil never realized what he was doing during the entire communion service. But the other members, they were very, very, very aware of what he was doing. However, they were too German and too Lutheran to do anything about it during the service. They just stoically accepted Emil's offering, although more than one member later sheepishly admitted to faking eating the wafer and hiding it in their closed hand until a later secret disposal. But right after the service, even though there was a Cowboys kickoff just minutes away, an emergency church council meeting was called. By a unanimous vote, the trial period for a communion assistant was immediately called to a halt. And it was a long, long, long time before anyone ever mentioned changing St. Martin's traditional worship service again. Because the members never forgot that Sunday when they did try something new, and it had turned into a disaster. thanks to Emil Alfterwahl's slip of the tongue. Well, I'm glad to know that non-Texans can appreciate that. You may not know what Scott is. Red Miller here will tell you what Scott is if you don't know what the game of Scott is. Well, is that the dismissal bell? I think we have the flock gathered, and as I said at the beginning, this is the third in the series, The Lighter Side of Faith, and this one is You Don't Have to Chase Rabbits All the Time, which is concerned primarily with the Sabbath and rest and what place it plays in our lives, not only as human beings, but especially as Christians. The first part of August, my wife and I took off a week, celebrated our 40th wedding anniversary to each other, and we flew into Reno and did some things in Reno for a couple of days, and then we went up to Lake Tahoe, and then we went down to Yosemite National Park and kind of spent a better part of a week roaming around the high Sierras and the high towns of that part of Nevada and Southern California. It was a very refreshing time for us, not only just because we were getting away from the heat of Texas, but because my wife is a university administrator, and the end of August is the end of the fiscal year of state government in Texas. She works for a state university, and she is an accountant in charge of close to 200 accounts that she has to balance, she and her staff of 10, by August the 31st. Interestingly enough, they have found out some way to get an August 32nd on their computer. I don't know anything about computers, but I find that interesting. But she needed some getaway time, and I always need getaway time. I lead such a busy life. And but anyway, it was very interesting. We landed in Reno when they were right in the middle of what they call hot August nights, which I'd never really heard of before, but evidently is becoming a major festival in that part of the country. It's a celebration of the 50s. They bring back all the old rock groups, plus all the hot rod custom cars were there. And for those of us of the 50s, it was kind of a neat thing, except there were 175,000 visitors in downtown Reno, and we were trying to get from the hotel to or from the airport to our hotel, and like never got there. Then we went to Lake Tahoe, and this was the time of the year when everybody and their families were there. And then I knew better, but we were in the vicinity, and we hadn't planned that well when we got married on August the 7th to celebrating our 40th anniversary when nobody else was around. So we go down to Yosemite National Park, and it was literally wall-to-wall cars getting in. And in the valley, it was, well, we wanted to go to the visitor center, and we could not even find a parking place, literally within about a mile on that particular day. 100,000 people down there in this wilderness area. But we thoroughly enjoyed Yosemite anyway. Not only did we need to get away, but a whole lot of other people did too. It was vacation time. It was summer time. Everybody, whether they wanted to or not, loading up their family or whoever that may be and going off. Somebody said, have you ever spent a month in an RV with the people supposedly you love? I think that points out a fact that all of us, deep down in our souls and hearts somewhere, have that feeling, that urge to get away from it all. And I have that quite regularly, and the place that I get away from it all on a regular basis is, if you've been around a couple of other sessions, is a Texas Hill Country ranch that now is mine by the gift of inheritance, been in our family almost 100 years. And I think it is safe to say I probably would not be here today, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, if I had not had that family ranch to run away to over the years. Anytime the stresses and strains of life got too bad, I when I needed to stop and smell the goats, that's where I went. We'll talk more about goats tomorrow, but we raise Angora goats as well as cattle on that ranch. And there is a couple of ranch houses out there, one that my grandfather built for his bride in '05 when they got married, a quarried stone house, 18 inches thick stone, very German style, very neat house. The other house my dad built in around 1941, it's a lesser impressive house and frame house, but it was my home, and I still tend to make my base out at the ranch in that house. We actually live in town away, I should say, 118 miles away. That's how far I commute to work. So, anyway, in the living room of the frame house out there, over the couch, I have a poster, and it shows an old hound dog asleep in the grass, and the caption on the poster is, "You don't have to chase rabbits all the time." I love that poster. I think it is so appropriate where it is because that's the place I go when I get tired of chasing all the rabbits of my other careers. I also think that that is a religious poster or a religious saying. At least it communicates a very basic religious truth to me, and that is the truth of the commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now, I dare say that the first thought which comes to mind when most Christians hear that commandment is worship. To remember the Sabbath day is to go to church. Martin Luther emphasized that when in his small catechism he said, "The meaning of this commandment is," and you may feel free to join in, "we should fear and love God so that we do not despise his word and the preaching of the same, but deem it holy and gladly hear it and learn it." Hear and learn it. Okay. Some of you were saying it in German, weren't you? We Lutherans know how to brainwash our children in confirmation. Well, all that's fine and good, but I'm afraid that we have overemphasized the worship aspect of this commandment at the expense of the rest aspect. Sabbath, I think as we are all aware, if you have been trained well, is the Hebrew word that means
rest.
So this commandment really says, remember to keep the day of rest holy. In fact, if you will listen to that commandment in its entirety, which we don't always hear, I think you catch that idea. Let me read the whole commandment, the Exodus 28 through 11 passage, and this is from the Good News Bible. "Observe the Sabbath and keep it holy. You have 6 days in which to do your work, but the seventh day is a day of rest dedicated to me. On that day, no one is to work, neither you, your children, your slaves, your animals." We ranchers find that interesting. "Nor the foreigners who live in your country." We Texas ranchers find that interesting. "In 6 days, I, the Lord, made the earth, the sky, the seas, and everything in them. But on the seventh day, I rested. And that's why I, the Lord, blessed the Sabbath and made it holy." And when you hear that in its entirety, you really catch that emphasis on rest. In fact, physical rest was the chief element in the Jewish Sabbath observance. So Bill got into some of this morning in his Bible study, if you're talking about that. Worship was encouraged, of course, but I think it is safe to say that to the Jew, the worship element of the Sabbath was secondary in many respects to the rest aspect. In fact, we might even say that for the Jews, rest was worship, a way of remembering and honoring the Creator God who rested on the Sabbath day. And the least we can say is that the Jews definitely regarded rest as holy, and they went to all kinds of lengths with all kinds of elaborate rules about what one could and could not do on the Sabbath to make sure people would rest on that day and therefore keep it holy. My mind is a little bit blank right now at some of the rules that people have collected, some of the rather ridiculous state to which they took some of those. For example, couldn't wear false teeth because that was carrying a burden on the Sabbath and so forth. But in spite of all that, the basic thing that they were trying to do was make sure that people rest. Now, I'm sure that all of us have heard plenty about the worship side of this commandment, but maybe not so much about the rest side. So that's what I'd like to talk about this morning, and I hope you understand that I'm not de-emphasizing worship whatsoever. I think that's very important, and even if I didn't think so, I'd have to say there, I'd get kicked out of the preacher's unit. And also, since I'm doing Vespers this evening, worship is very important, so don't forget. However, I think rest is important too. It is not a question of either or. It's a both and situation. To remember the Sabbath is both to worship and to rest. Now, to understand the importance of rest in the divine scheme of things, I think we need to really kind of stop and remember the basic purpose of the Ten Commandments. I like to compare the Ten Commandments to the owner's manual for a new car. You know, you get a new car or you buy a used car, it's new to you, and usually there is a owner's manual, even still in used cars. The glove compartment, what we call it in Texas, I don't know what you call it where you are, it's a trash receptacle in most of us. But there is an owner's manual in there. And if you really want to get the best service out of that vehicle, as we call it in Texas, you read the owner's manual. There in the manufacturer tells you, for example, what tire pressure, what oil to use, how often to change it, what kind of service routine. The basic idea is that if you follow the directions of the maker of that car, it should give you long and carefree service, which is the desire of the owner. He wants satisfied customers, and it's definitely the desire of the owner. You don't want to be messing around with car repairs all the time. Now, when God gave we human beings life, he also gave us an owner's manual, a guideline on how to make the most of life. And that owner's manual, in its most simplified form, is the Ten Commandments. You follow these suggestions from the manufacturer of life, and you should be able to live life to its fullest. You follow these guidelines, and you will prevent many of the breakdowns that can mess up your enjoyment of life. So what it boils down to, that these Ten Commandments are just very, very, very practical suggestions on how to live life with a minimum of problems and a maximum of benefits. And right in the middle of these guidelines for good living, right in the middle and on the same level with knowing and honoring God and your parents, and on the same level with not killing, not committing adultery, not stealing, not lying, not coveting, on the same level with all of these wise and obvious guidelines for living is the commandment, remember to rest. Rest, in the eyes of God, is on the same level with all those other obvious commandments and guidelines. The message is clear to me, and that is God thinks rest is good for us. That rest is essential for getting the most out of life. Which leads to the obvious question, why? Why is rest good for us? Somebody brought this up yesterday when we were talking about play. I'll expand on this a little bit. There's an old story in Texas about two old cedar choppers, as we call them down there, people who go out and make a living cutting cedar trees for a fence post and that kind of thing. They went out one day for a day of cedar chopping. And there were two of them, and they kind of were chopping cedar in the same general area. And the one of them, I mean, he went at it. He was a workaholic, you know. He was probably Lutheran. I mean, he worked all day. He didn't take a break or anything. He just worked right straight through 8 hours. And when he got through, he had this huge stack of cedar posts, as you might imagine. The other cedar chopper was a little more laid back. He had worked for about 50 minutes out of each hour, and then he'd take a little break for about 10 minutes. Then he'd go back and chop cedar for another 50 minutes, and he'd take a little break. Well, at the end of the day, when the cedar chopper who had been cutting straight through and had a big stack of logs and posts looked over at the guy who had been taking a break out of every hour, he was shocked to see that this guy had a bigger pile of cedar posts than he did. And he said, "I don't understand that. How can you, taking a break every hour, end up with more posts in your pile than me?" And the other cedar just smiled and said, "Well, very simple. Whenever I took a break, I sharpened my axe." Rest is a way of sharpening our axe. It's again one of those obvious truths of life that I've been talking about that most of us, for some reason or another, tend to forget sometimes. That when your axe gets dull, you're not going to cut as many posts as if it were sharp. And there are times we have to stop and sharpen our axe. Yesterday when we were talking about play, we were saying that play has a lot of good benefits, and that's fine and good for us to remember, but one of the really neat things about play is that it's just an end in itself. That we don't have to justify playing. We can just play for the fun of it. Rest has a certain amount of that as well. I think there is times when we just rest because we need it and we want to and we enjoy it, and rest can be fun. But rest does have a little more purpose, I think, in the divine scheme of things. It is, in many respects, a means to an end. Rest, quite frankly, enables us to work, to sharpen our axe. Someone has said, the harder you work, the harder the work. And there's an old Yugoslavian proverb that says, a good rest is half the work. You don't have to chase rabbits all the time. There are times when you need to stop, rest, stop and refresh yourself so you can get the energy to get up and continue on the trail. And one obvious way that rest is good for us is that it refreshes our bodies. It refreshes us physically. Normally, work and exercise are good for us physically. Not putting that down at all. There's no question about that. But there are limits. There are limits. Overwork and fatigue can be destructive to us physically. Not only injuring our bodies, but also curtailing our work. Ashley Brilliant, whom if you have not discovered, I would like to recommend. I was going to bring some of his books over. You'll find several of his books over in the bookstore, and right by the cash register there is a collection of his potshot postcards, and they are brilliant. That's his real name. Little short sayings that sometimes just have great philosophical truth in them, and his books are collections of those if you'd like to look those up. Anyway, he has made the wise observation, there is a wonderful method of relieving fatigue caused by overwork. It's called rest. Some of the obvious things in life we need to be reminded about. And John Hamlet affirms that observation when he writes, "There is always a quiet time in forest all over the world. While only some people take a siesta, there is a tendency on the part of almost every wild creature to stop what it is doing and rest in the afternoon. Usually between the hours of 1 and 3 o'clock, almost no wildlife is moving. If you are hunting for game then, you just might as well put your gun down and take a nap. If you are freshwater fishing," is this true, Jonathan? Yesterday they weren't biting in the middle of the day?
No.
Oh, they're the fishermen.
They weren't.
See, if you'd asked me, I'd tell you. Lay down and took a nap, huh? Okay. If you're freshwater fishing, the same generally holds true. Maybe this instinct to rest
is nature's way of preventing cardiac failure among its creatures. I come from a rural background, and I still like to take my nap in the middle of the day. Texas is just too hot to work. And not everybody understands that nowadays, but I still try to. And the late columnist Louis Grizzard continues the thought when he wrote, "We are a driven people, Americans. We get that from our parents who taught us it is sinful and disgraceful not to strive at all endeavors. We get it because we were taught to compete with the first Monopoly board we got for Christmas. And we get it because we are afraid if we do slow down for a moment, then somebody's going to run over us." I have a friend who is Greek, he says. He doesn't jog. He doesn't play tennis. He arises at 11 o'clock in the morning. He eats lunch. He sips a few glasses of wine, and he takes a siesta. He's 55. He looks like he's 35. And he once told me, "You Americans need to learn the Greek rule. Make no sudden moves." And Grizzard says, "We never will slow down completely, of course, but perhaps we should all at least set one day a week aside to be totally good for nothing. No exercise, no serious thoughts, no work of any nature, no sudden moves. Just lie around and eat Twinkies and scratch where it itches. We might live longer." Unquote. The sad thing about that is, if you know anything about Louis Grizzard, he just died sometime within the last year from about his third heart transplant or whatever. He did not practice what he preaches. Or preached, I guess we should say. But he was still fun to read. If you have not read Louis Grizzard, he was a Southern-style columnist. As we say in Texas, every once in a while I get my tongue wrapped around my eye teeth so I can't see how to read. So, well, the point is that rest is good for us. It refreshes our bodies. And rest also refreshes our minds and our souls. Mental and spiritual fatigue are just as destructive as is physical fatigue, if not more so in many ways. How many people do you know who have suffered burnout or depression or stress? Maybe you don't know anybody else. Maybe you just know yourself that has done that. And that can literally wipe us out. It can take all the creativity out of our work. The deepest, darkest part of my life was about a 5-year period in the early 70s when I had what was officially called hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, which is a demonic kind of disease. I guess that's what you have to call it, because it's really caused by stress and poor diet. And the more you get under stress, usually the more poor your diet is. And it was just a horrendous water wheel, treadmill kind of thing for me to get off of. I finally did, and I'm back to fairly normal. But I don't care to ever get in that deep, dark pit of despair again. It's just very destructive to all kinds of things. And I guess that maybe is why I'm so concerned about taking care of myself and making other people aware, too, of how they can take care of themselves so not to get into that kind of living hell. Anyway, when we do get into that kind of situation, that's a pretty good sign that we need a vacation to get away from our work. Or if it's maybe just a mini vacation, as some would have said, a vacation is what you take when you can no longer take what you've been taking all along. Our Robert Orban has a definition of a vacation that I always think of when I come to Holden Village, and that is, a vacation is having nothing to do and all day to do it in. So I hope you're on vacation. Walter Beecher wonders, who invented recess? And he says, almost surely it was a teacher who found that students learn a whole lot more with recess than without recess. And those of you who are into art, Leonardo da Vinci commented on the artist's need to get away from his work, and he said, every now and then, go away and have a little relaxation. For when you come back to your work, your judgment will be sure, since to remain constantly at work will cause you to lose the power of judgment. You go some distance away because then the work appears smaller and more of it can be taken at a glance and a lack of harmony or proportion is more readily seen. Paul da Vinci is saying, sometimes you have to fall back to get perspective, to really see what's going on. And sometimes the only way you can see yourself and what's really happening to you is to back off in a vacation or some sort of getaway situation and really say, that's me. That's where I am. So getting away, taking a Sabbath, taking a rest from our work is good for us. It can refresh our minds and our souls. And rest also refreshes our relationships. When we get tired of body, mind, or soul, not only does that affect us, it affects those around us. Tired people often can't work to their full capacity, shifting the burden of their work onto the shoulders of somebody else. Tired people often don't have the energy or the inclination to socialize. Honey, let's go dancing. Oh, I've been tired all week. So one stays home and rests, the other stays home and fumes and fusses. Tired people are often cranky people. They are easily irritated and hard to live with. Who wants to live with cranky people? Rest is one of the ways that we can ease this personal pressure and open us up to meaningful relationships. The ancient philosopher Plato observed many truths, and one that I especially agree with, and I meant to quote yesterday, but I'll make it up today, and that is, Plato said, you can discover more about a person in an hour of play than you can in a year of conversation. Sometimes you only really see another person as they are when you play with them in leisure times. I find it interesting that many corporations nowadays, when they are going to interview people, they will invite the prospective executive to maybe go play golf or go fishing or something like that. And the interviewees, very flattered. They're going to have a little social time. They don't realize that's a very important part of the interview process, that they can really tell by the way somebody plays how they're going to work. So play is an excellent way, leisure time away, for us to really break down those barriers. As I mentioned the other day in the humor presentation, take that cloak off so that we can really get to know and see each other as we really are. The relaxed atmosphere of play and recreation causes all of this barriers to be taken down, pretensions to be dropped. These are times when we often see people as they really are, and they see us as we really are. Lynn Hunter Caldwell caught the essence of what I'm trying to say about in the connection between rest and relationships in a little article that was published in Reader's Digest several years ago, which I think is worth sharing at this particular time. She says, I rolled over in bed and reached for the small spiral notebook with my neatly printed little list of things to do that day. My husband Steve always teased me about my written schedule, but if I didn't organize the night before, how else would I get through my work each day? This morning, the notation clean hall closet glowered from the top of my list. Dispiritedly, I began rummaging through mismatched shoes, games with missing pieces, and boxes of unmarked photographs. And then I saw it, lying in a tangled heap in the corner, the hammock. And I recalled how husband Steve and I had laughed when my brother first gave it to us. At that particular time, except for two spindly trees, our property was barren back then. And we put the useless gift right in the back of the closet. But now, glancing out the window, I saw the two large, sturdy trees that had grown from those reedy transplants. And then I surprised myself, she says, by stepping out into the blinding sunlight and on tiptoe carefully stretched the hammock between the two strong trunks. The baby's agitated cry broke my reverie. Little Corey was hungry, and I was quite adept at nursing her while holding her in one arm and using my free arm to dust her vacuum. But just this once, I thought guiltily, we'll rest in the hammock. And Corey and I settled in like birds in a nest, and she nursed as I sought the clouds through the leafy canopy. The world was empty of human sound, but I heard a woodpecker rat-a-tat-tatting and the wind rustling the leaves. I felt completely at peace. And then the feeling of guilt, God's world will be here tomorrow, but the baby will need clean diapers today. Later, at 3 o'clock, I heard the slow footsteps of my 6-year-old son coming into the house, and I looked up and noticed his forlorn face. "What's up, Chris?" I asked. "Oh, nothing," he replied, obviously unwilling to talk. "Look," I said, pointing through the window, "I got a surprise for you." And he looked out and he said, "Hey, wow, neato, can we go out and get in it?" So together we walked outside and slipped into the hammock's embrace. Put an arm around my son. I hadn't held him that close in a long time, and I was surprised he didn't pull away. "You know what happened in school today?" Chris asked plaintively. That big kid Robbie, he's been picking on me, calling me names, and today in front of all the other guys, he tried to pull my pants down. Muffled sobs shook the hammock. I was furious at that bully, but I felt happy, too. Chris had opened his heart up to me. That contained little boy who rarely spoke his feelings was trusting me with a very fragile part of himself. Well, that evening, husband Steve dragged in from work looking exhausted. After the children were in bed, I led him out to the hammock. And we couldn't help but lie together and watch the moon rise, and old dreams were awakened. We talked away the hours. We felt closer than we had in a long, long time. The next morning when I awoke, I glanced at my bedside table, and on it was a note from Steve, who had already left for work, and that was, "Please, put the hammock on your list for tonight." End of story. You don't have to chase rabbits all the time. There are times when we need to stop, stretch out, rest, and relax, because rest is good for us. It refreshes our bodies, our minds, our souls, and our relationships. Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. Remember to rest. Rest is holy. Well, those are my prepared thoughts on the subject. And now we will all rest. We will leave you a few minutes here for any feedback and reaction, comments, agreements, disagreements that you might have on the subject.
We all have been resting.
You
know,
yes.
You know, Marvin Dawn wrote a book on this subject, and I don't know whether you're familiar with her writings at all or not, but what she pointed out was something you sort of alluded to, and that is that not everybody can keep what we think of as the Sabbath, but you need to set aside a day, sometime in the week, that you do, in fact, treat as your day of rest. Whether it comes to be Sunday or not, one needs to set aside that time.
Well, it's interesting you said Sunday, and if we were going to be literal, the Sabbath would be Saturday, yes. We Christians have already monkeyed with the Sabbath. So I think the basic idea I'm very comfortable with, I don't think that God would send me to hell if I were to say that the whole idea of Sabbath is to include rest in your life. you could be a little more literally and say on a 1/7 basis, whatever, the actual day becomes somewhat secondary to that. But the whole idea is, yes, make sure that you have rest and Sabbath in your life, whatever proportion you may need. Different people need different things, but yeah. There are a couple of books, as long as we're talking about books. These are the same two I mentioned yesterday because play and rest seem to go together. One is The Christian at Play by Robert Johnson. The other is Leisure, A Spiritual Need by Leonard Doohan. This one I think may be out of print. I'm not sure. This one I got up here last year in the bookstore, and when I came in, there were a couple there. The same person bought these that bought, who was it, Jerry, or who was, or Bill? Somebody was saying their books were gone. I go to so many lectures that I can't remember. But these are both excellent thought provokers on the idea of leisure, Sabbathing, and the place they play in our lives and in our faith.
Who was the author of the Reader's Digest article?
Wasn't me. Lynn Hunter Caldwell. It was originally in Guidepost magazine, but I got it from Reader's Digest. I don't even have the date on it, but yes, ma'am.
I've heard it said that a change of work is rest. And you're working at something that takes a lot of physical exertion, and then you do something that I sometimes have a lot of things I have to get done. I try to do something I like to do that I find joy in doing more than other things, and find that relaxes me somehow too.
Rest is kind of like what we defined yesterday as work and play. One person's work is another person's play and vice versa, and one person's rest is another person's work. You really have to, I think, define for yourself what is rest in your life. I'm not about to get up here and say everybody should get in a hammock. I don't like hammocks myself. I sure like my bed in Chalet 10. Boy, I've had some good naps on it, I tell you that.
What about your people who rest and worship at the same time?
They are among the highest of the chosen.
They wake up when you say amen.
We have a lot of those. I will say nothing about sleeping in church at all.
Well, to rest, you have to eliminate some irritants that may keep you from resting, like the telephone, the TV, the mosquitoes, a few other things that you have to eliminate them to come to complete rest. And maybe sometimes you have to take care of the little children so that you can rest.
In other words, you have to take care of your work.
Right.
You know what you're saying? That's spoken like a true German, Red Miller.
Work at rest.
Well, the problem is a lot of times a lot of people cannot rest because the shadow, cloud, whatever you want to call it, of their work is over them. And that's exactly what happened to me back in those hypoglycemia days. I had insomnia because I was just worried about everything under the sun. And so if you kind of put everything else in order, this ties in with all of it, then you can rest better. Mm-hmm. I don't have time to get into all that. Somebody had a question.
This change of occupation reminds me, the ancient Hebrews also had a sabbatical year.
Mm-hmm. Say more about that?
Oh, I'd rather you say more about that.
You sound like you know more about it than I do.
I don't know.
Yeah, every seventh year.
Did they really do that? Did they really do that?
I will refer to the biblical scholar in the back of the room, Bill. I know Jubilee never came off. I'm not sure about the seventh.
I don't know that much about it.
You caught me with my homework now.
Well,
yes.
I was going to say that I don't worry quite as much about
my generation, I won't say our generation, as I do about our kids' generation on this one. Because our kids in their late 20s and 30s, and I have the feeling that something has changed in terms of the role of work, and that they are somehow driven more than I ever was to work, and at work, part of maybe the downsizing, that is that there's more, you know, to do than they can get done, but also that work has become a way of life more than a job, and that if they're not working, they're out playing frenetically. So that it becomes work, and I'd be interested in reaction. I really worry about the generation in their 30s, particularly, maybe early 40s, who seem to me are becoming a kind of a different kind of workaholic. And I wonder if they're escaping a lot of that they could find in relationships and in rest and in faith and so forth. I'm just interested in any reaction to that.
Well, every time I tend to want to say this generation is worse than mine, sure. I start looking back at myself, and I'm not too sure. But I think someone has said, and this was many years ago, that so many of us Americans work at our play. Yeah. You know, we can't just sit back and relax. We got to go out and compete, whether it's at the bowling alley, the golf course, or bridge table or wherever, and boy, we really work at playing, which is kind of contradictory. There's no question that, from my point of view, that in a world that's kind of changing, where fewer people are in essence working with their hands and more working with their minds, boy, that, and anybody who says that working with your mind is easier than working with your hands hadn't ever worked with your mind very much. In many days, I'd much rather be out on a postal digger at my ranch than sitting having to meet a writing deadline, or especially when I was a pastor, the most draining physical experience I would have would be sitting down in a counseling session with one person and being that, say, for an hour. I would come out of that just drained, just really drained. But I see that, you know, the people who punched a time clock could leave work and go home and kind of leave work behind. Boy, I see a lot of people in their cars and on the buses and coming into my house. My university administrative wife very seldom comes home without a briefcase. And does her home relaxing and then goes and has a few things to do before go back to the office tomorrow. I think it's getting harder and harder to get away from your work. And that is what can be demonic, destructive. And I think that's where...
Does the cellular phone add to that?
Pardon me?
How about the cellular phone adding to that? Is she ever talking on her telephone when she walks in the front door?
Well, I was reminded of that on our vacation, which I was telling you about. I float all over, and just because of the nature of my work, I'm very dependent on my phone, and I have an answering machine, which is a lifesaver. It really covers my tracks. But I almost have to check my phone messages at least once a day, sometimes more often than that, even when I'm on vacation. And it's and I was doing that, you know, I'd have to, in the middle of the day, I'd have to remember, now, say, what time is it in Texas? I got all that kind of stuff. And very shortly after we got home, the Austin American paper, which some of you may have read, had a, and I think it was a syndicated column, maybe going all across the country, and did a little, somebody, I think it was a phone company maybe, had done a survey of what people were doing on vacations and how often they were calling home. And it was extremely high percentage. And the conclusion of this article was, by this particular interpreter, was that yes, this modern technology is a blessing, but
you can't hardly ever get away from it. And, you know, it's nice to be able to call home and get your messages. But isn't Holden Village grand that there are no telephones?
No television.
And I think that I cannot live without checking my message machine for a week, and I'm going to go 10 days without it. And I told my wife, you have full authority to take any $10,000 speaking engagements you can get. So I'm going to go home, and it's just going to be... somebody over here was... Yes.
Well, I share the same concern that was mentioned about the next generation, and I think for myself, what I have done is change rest. In other words, it isn't just on Sunday, but I rest at other times because Sunday I might be involved in things that are not restful. And I think that for our next generation, we have not allowed a day to be a day that they visibly see us resting. And so I don't think they're even aware that we might rest. So I think losing that day visibility is a concern.
Yeah, society doesn't make much distinction between Sunday anymore. We had blue laws in Texas for years until, 10, 15 years ago? Now, Sunday is not much different than any other day, except it just opens at noon usually. Can't buy beer till afternoon. Just a couple of comments about the church in the short time we have. The people that I am most concerned about, I think, at all this stress, tension, business, are my peers in the ministry. Who breaks the Sabbath most of all in our society because we expect him or her to, those are pastors. Sunday can be you go through leading two worship services in a Sunday school class, and I can guarantee you, you'll be wiped out by lunch. But it's the whole rest of it. Yes, I think every call has a minister's day off and vacation time. But very few that I know are able or do take all those days off. Many times they can't because it's my day off, but this person didn't call to check my schedule before they died. And people somehow don't understand. I'm sorry, I cannot come. It's my day off. And then a lot of ministers are just driven themselves, and even though it is their day off, I just got so much to do. Man, I better stay around here and catch up. So I'm concerned about my ministers, friends, and colleagues. I'm also concerned about the church. I love the church, but I continually have a lover's quarrel with my church. And one of the things that really kind of concerns me nowadays is that the church has become one big agenda. And we feel that the church is not doing its work unless it has some sort of program or activity almost every day, every hour of the week. And along with that goes the added implied pressure that we expect every member to be at every occasion. Even though we say we're trying to get, a varied program here to meet everybody's needs, the pastor and the church council and everybody usually smiles a little more at you the more of these activities you get to. And as I say, that's such a subtle little thing. I'm not against church programming and church activities. I think that's all fine and good. But sometimes, we expect people to take away from their rest time. We forget, especially those in the clergy, that those people have spent a hard day in their world, their work all day, and then we expect them to come and be at a meeting or to come at some social activity or educational activity in the evening. We really, I think, need to examine that and very carefully and very sensitively.